I'm David Crow. Thank you for tuning into episode 172 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crow with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Listen every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time here on prn.fm or download the MP3 after broadcast with iTunes or other podcast apps. You can listen to any of the last 5 episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990 and follow the instructions. You will be responsible for any long-distance charges. Remember that I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and if you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift, which will be one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photos. If you'd like to sponsor the show as an individual or advertiser, please contact me. You can donate via PayPal using the email david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com or make monthly donations at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want the show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information you're gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. If you'd like me to speak at a meeting of an organization you're a member of on just about any of the topics I've covered in my shows, I'd be happy to discuss this with you. I appreciate you commenting and suggesting guests. I appreciate your financial support as well. Thanks for listening and for recommending this show to your friends. Jennifer wrote in, I love the show. It's been very enlightening. I was wondering if you could do a show on meningitis and how effective the vaccine is. When I try and do my own research, I find it very confusing. Also, if getting the vaccine for young kids is necessary. Thank you very much. I don't know of a critic of the meningitis vaccine or somebody who's a promoter of the vaccine who actually knows a lot about it. I do remember when my own children were younger and I wrote to my local provincial government about the meningitis vaccine. They were kind enough to send me a little paper that showed one graph from a country in Africa where there was a meningitis epidemic. They gave a vaccine, the epidemic got worse, and then they gave another vaccine and the epidemic resolved. I think what they were trying to say is that if you take two vaccines, you have immunity. But there were many other interpretations to the graph, and there was really nothing else in the research that they sent me that it convinced me that the vaccine was very effective. So if anybody knows of somebody who could talk in an educated way about the vaccine, the pros and the cons, and any possible side effects of the vaccines, I'd greatly appreciate it. I do appreciate getting suggestions for guests for this show. My guest today, Mark Pendergrast, has been described as the ultimate freelance journalist with an eclectic mind. He's written 14 books, at least one of which we'll spend time discussing today. Not his three children's books, for those who are hoping for a more relaxed show. You can tell about his interests by his membership in the National Association of Science Writers, the Society of Environmental Journalists, and others. He hasn't just written books, he's also been a book reviewer for major newspapers and has written many articles in newspapers and magazines as well. He has a BA in English from Harvard and an MA in library science. He's become an expert in the area of repressed memory, and that's one of the subjects in the book we'll focus on today, The Most Hated Man in America, a book about Jerry Sandusky's pedophilia trial. He has three books specifically on repressed memory, Memory Warp, The Repressed Memory Epidemic, and Victims of Memory. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you with me today. I'm not easily shocked, but I admit that I was shocked when I saw a tweet referencing a review of your book saying Jerry Sandusky might be innocent. And I was shocked because the crimes as described were so heinous, and I thought that the evidence was solid. I'd never questioned it. And I was shocked also because they were tweeted by the feminist Katha Pollitt, because the idea that a man accused of sexual assault could be innocent is not really popular in this age of believed the victim. So can you briefly summarize for people who might have forgotten, what's the common understanding of Jerry Sandusky? And then we'll talk about what's wrong with that theory.
Sure. He was an assistant coach for Joe Paterno at Penn State in the football team for about 30 years, and he was revered there almost as much as Paterno himself. He was the defensive coordinator, and many people thought that Penn State would never have done as well without him. Unlike Paterno, he didn't yell at his players. He was friendly and nice and joked around with them, but he also got them to play better. Now, he also started a children's charity called the Second Mile in 1977 to help troubled youth, and it was for both boys and girls, but he became a mentor for quite a few of the Second Mile kids. He was personally involved in the program, and he would even go and exercise with them and take showers with them after the exercise sometimes, and he would have them come to his home, and he basically said that he treated them as if they were extended members of his family. In 2008, a young man named Aaron Fisher, who was just turned 15, I think, he told his mother he didn't want to go with Sandusky anymore. He said he was creepy. And so they got the idea that maybe he had sexually abused him. But when he went to see the Department of Children and Families, they asked what he'd done. The most they could get him to say was that Sandusky would wrestle around with him and crack his back with both of their clothes on.
Right.
They were sure that something else must have happened to him, so they sent him to therapy.
They sent the boy to therapy, not Sandusky.
Yeah, the boy,
yeah.
Aaron Fisher. And Gillum was sure that something else had happened to him, and he eventually got him to remember or say that he had undergone oral sex with Sandusky and all kinds of other terrible things. That is what started the case.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, and it took them 2 years before there was anybody else who would say that Sandusky did anything to them. But eventually, they got an assistant coach named Mike McQuarrie to say that 10 years before, he had been in the locker room and had heard sounds, slapping sounds that sounded like sex.
Right.
And that it had been Sandusky sodomizing a boy in the shower, and he remembered seeing this. So that was the most damning evidence to me when I first heard about the case, and I think
right.
for most other people,
yep.
Is that there was this eyewitness who saw this, and then they got a whole bunch of other Second Mile kids to say things. But the problem with the case, David,
mm-hmm.
and I will say that when I heard about it, I had the same reaction you did. Of course he's guilty. Why would I pay any attention to this?
Right.
The reason I began to pay attention to it was in 2013, a woman named Glenna Kirker sent me an email. I didn't know who she was. She had read one of my books. And she said, you need to look at the Sandusky case because there's a lot of repressed memory in it.
Oh, okay, so that's the connection, yeah, which makes sense.
So I said, yeah, but what about that guy McQuarrie who saw him abusing the kid in the shower? And she said, no, that doesn't hold up either. You need to look at this. And I'll look at anything.
Okay.
So I did. And the more I looked at it, the smellier it got. And to make a long story short, and it's a 391-page book.
Right.
Very well documented. But I must say, many people have said it reads like a legal thriller, so it's not hard to read. But I concluded that Sandusky probably is entirely innocent, and it's almost impossible to believe. But I can go through each of the 10 supposed victims that were at the trial, two of whom were anonymous and so didn't testify, one of whom didn't exist at all. We're not going to have time to do that, probably. So I'll just let you lead me. But
okay.
Just let me say one thing, David. Mm-hmm. Let me just say this to your listeners: there's no way we're going to be able to cover this case in any kind of detail to try to convince people that I'm right. The only way to do that is for them to read the entire book, and I urge that they go out and do it. It's only $20, or it's $8 for a Kindle version.
Right.
And if you're interested in legal cases, if you're interested in psychology, it's an amazing story. I never would have believed it. So go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, no, I agree. I read the book, and, you know, it as it really needs to be, it's quite methodical and quite chronological. I don't think the whole book's in chronological order because there was an earlier incident in the 1990s that became important later. What did McQuarrie originally say that he saw when he first reported the events?
Well, this is according to a guy named Jonathan Dranoff, who is a doctor, who was Mike McQuarrie's father's boss. So when Mike called his father from the gym and he was all upset, and he said, I overheard these sounds and I'm all upset, and I think Sandusky is doing something with kids. So his father said, come right over. And he also, his father called his boss to come over. And Dranoff seems to be the most rational person in this case.
Right.
And he's testified, and he said, I kept asking Mike, but what did you see? Asked him three times, but what did you see? Well, he didn't see anything. He heard slapping sounds, and he decided they were sexual. And then he looked in the mirror in the locker room, and he saw a boy's face sort of peek out the side and an arm reach and grab him back in. And then he saw Sandusky and the boy come out of the shower. But he didn't actually look into the shower and see anything. And I know what was going on in the shower because not only did Sandusky tell us about it, so did the boy in the shower.
Who was Alan Myers.
Right. Alan Myers, who had written a letter supporting Sandusky before this grand jury presentment came out with the story about the sodomy in the shower. And that came out in November of 2011. When Myers saw it, he realized, I was that kid. That was me. We were snapping towels at each other in the shower.
Right.
And he went and he gave a statement to Sandusky's lawyer's investigator saying exactly what had happened, saying, Sandusky was a mentor to me. I had him stand up at my senior football game instead of my father. I drove many hours to go to his mother's funeral. I stayed with him for a summer after I got out of school. He's been nothing but a wonderful mentor to me, and he's never, touched me. Then, the same kid, Alan Myers, found a lawyer, happened to be his DUI lawyer. He'd been arrested for being under the influence when he was driving. And suddenly, he flipped. He has never said exactly what he now says Sandusky was supposed to do. And he never testified at the trial, and he was called victim number two, and everybody pretended they didn't know who he was. Everybody knew who he was, the prosecution and the defense.
Right.
But they didn't call him because the prosecution was afraid that they would haul out this incredibly strong statement that he didn't do anything to him. The defense was afraid because now he had flipped and had become a, quote, victim. I think the defense made a huge mistake in not calling him to the stand. But they didn't. And this is typical of so many of the quote, victims in this case, that they initially said he didn't do anything, and then they changed their mind, often under the influence of very leading police questioning or therapy and or the involvement of civil lawyers.
And money.
It's in many ways a case of follow the therapy and also follow the money.
Yes, and this psychiatrist who I keep wanting to call Gollum, which is from...
Gillum. G-I-L-L-U-M.
Yes.
I was able to interview him, too, and he wasn't... he's not a bad guy. He's a very well-meaning guy.
But you did say that on his bookshelf he had a book that's sort of the Bible of repressed memory therapists.
That's right. He had a book called The Courage to Heal by Ellen Bass and Laura Davis, which is, as you say, sort of the Bible of repressed memory therapy. And he told me that he, you know, believes in repressed memories, this whole theory, which we should probably talk about that theory. It's surprising to me. You know, I thought that nowadays, everybody knows that this is pseudoscience.
Right.
That people don't really repress traumatic memories. Well, I was wrong, and that's one of the reasons that I wrote Memory Warp and the Repressed Memory Epidemic, which both came out last year, because it's still going on, not just in the Sandusky case, but all over the country. And something like 85% of Americans believe in this theory, so probably 85% of your listeners do believe it, and they might be saying, well, so what if it was repressed memories in the Sandusky case? They probably were true.
Right, and I don't know if it was, I don't know which kid it was. I mean, obviously when these kids were testifying, they were adults, but when I'm talking about them being boys at that time. One of them who initially said nothing had happened and then later agreed that something had happened, I think you said that during the trial, he didn't actually say anything. He just cried when he was asked if anything had happened. Did I get that right?
No, I don't think that's true. I think that all of them said something.
Okay.
Aaron Fisher, during his grand jury testimony, they made him testify three times.
Right.
He basically never said anything. Yeah, he would just cry, or he would answer yes or no to direct questions.
Right.
Leading questions, which is what he did with Gillum, too, for a long time. But the one who most obviously was repressed memories, if you read the trial transcript, was quote, victim seven named Dustin Struble. And he was the only one who agreed to talk to me. So I was able to interview Dustin. Again, a nice young man who now totally believes that Sandusky molested him. But I asked him, I said, what would you have said, Dustin, in 2010, if I had interviewed you then about Sandusky, what would you have told me about him? He said, oh, I would have said that he was one of my best friends and that he was a mentor. And I said, you wouldn't have told me anything about abuse? No, because I didn't remember it. He didn't remember it. And so I said, well, was this repressed memory therapy? He said, oh, yes. Both of my therapists I've had suggested they were repressed memories. And he went on to describe how he'd remembered it, been triggered by seeing mesh pants like what he'd worn, or somebody who had chest hair like Sandusky's. But let me just, if you don't mind, can I give a little lesson in memory and how it works?
Yes, yeah, I was just going to ask you, like, can we impose memories, and if people have a known traumatic experience, do they tend to remember it or not remember it? If you can address those issues along with whatever else you want to tell us about it.
Yeah, well, you know, all memory is somewhat reconstructive. Many people think that you have everything that's ever happened to you is recorded somewhere in your brain, like in a computer or a filing cabinet, and that's not true. We forget a lot more than we remember, and what we do remember is stored in places all over our brains, and every time we recall it, we are reconstructing it. We're literally remembering. So all memory is subject to distortion and is somewhat malleable, but in general it works pretty well, and we usually get the general idea of what happened correct. Particularly what we remember are the worst things that happened to us or the best things, because we can then search out the best things. Oh, I remember this nice thing happened over here. Let's go over here. Or we can avoid the bad things. I don't want to be around that guy anymore because I remember he hit me the last time I saw him. So this myth that Sigmund Freud made up in 1895 was that if you were terribly traumatized as a child, that's the thing that you would forget, especially if it happened over and over again. You would forget it even more, and that's exactly the opposite of what is true. We tend to remember all too well the bad things that have happened to us.
Right.
But many therapists, starting in the late 1980s, especially after the publication of The Courage to Heal in 1988, began to specialize in trying to get people to remember things. And you can, in fact, it's a shock, but you can get people to remember in great detail and with great emotion things that never happened.
And you said there's experimental evidence of this. I mean, what kind of experiment would you do to prove that you could invent a memory for somebody else?
Well, it would be obviously unethical to actually do what millions of therapists have done, which is to try to convince somebody and to get them to remember terrible childhood sexual abuse. So instead, what the experimental psychologists have done, starting with Elizabeth Loftus, was to get people to recall things that are as close as you can get to child sexual abuse. So she did an ingenious experiment where she asked people to think about a time when they had been lost in a shopping mall when they were children, which she knew had not happened. She had interviewed their parents.
Mm-hmm.
And quite a few of them not only remembered it, but remembered it in great detail, remembered how they were crying, remembered how they were so happy when their parents found them, remember the man who helped them, etc. Since then, many, many other experiments have gotten people, you know, have convinced people that they committed a crime that they had forgotten. All kinds of things, that they had spilled a punch bowl at a wedding, all kinds
okay.
of things.
That, so relatively harmless memories, and you're not going to go as opposed to repressed memory of sexual abuse, where you might accuse your father or brother or an uncle or something of sexual abuse after going to a therapist.
That's right, and I think most people would say, well, yeah, there's a big difference between those experiments and getting you to think that your parents, who you love, did something to you, and why would anybody make up something so terrible? But you have to look at how this happened, and I do hope people will not only read The Most Hated Man in America, but will read Memory Warp. It's mm-hmm. also only $20, because it's abundantly clear once you read that how this happened. But when you go to therapy, you're going because you're unhappy and you're looking for answers to why, and you want to be better. So if the therapist says to you, well, you have all the symptoms of someone who is sexually abused, and I suspect you were abused, and until you remember it and get these repressed memories out, you'll never be happy. You'll never have a good relationship. You'll always be depressed. You'll always have an eating disorder. You'll always be this, that, or whatever it is that you came in for.
Yes.
And so most people would say, well, that can't be true. How would I know that, though? They say, well, we could hypnotize you, and we can get you to remember, or you might dream about it, or something will trigger you for it in your life, or you'll
right.
have some bodily pain that will remind you of it. And it doesn't really matter what methodology is used. It becomes sort of a self-fulfilling expectation. People become obsessed with finding out if this is true. They become sure that something must have happened to them. And then, lo and behold, they will dream about it, or if they allow themselves to be hypnotized, they will remember something that never happened, because hypnosis does not delve into your subconscious. It simply makes you highly suggestible.
Right. I mean, if people were skeptical, you would think that they're... it wouldn't be that difficult to prove that some of these events could not have happened, right? Like the events occurred on a day when the two people in common were not present in the same place, or something like that.
There were a few cases where people could do that, yes. Or there were a few cases of people who remembered being raped repeatedly as children, and they were examined medically, and they were virgins.
Right.
So you could disprove those, but most of them, no. I mean, sex abuse is not something that you do in public.
Right.
And so you couldn't disprove most of these things.
Obviously, this has a big impact on the family. I mean, I think it goes without saying, if you accuse a relative of sexual abuse when you were a child, that could end up with somebody being in jail, or at the very least with the family being fractured, with people siding with one side or the other. But does it also have a negative impact on the person undergoing the therapy?
Yes, I know of all too many cases of people who committed suicide after becoming convinced that these horrible things had been done to them inside their own family. But in general, there were more suicide attempts than suicides. But it throws people into a complete state of despair and misery.
Right.
They can't sleep. They sometimes can't eat. It ruins their marriages. It ruins their careers. It's a terrible thing to believe. And what really irritates me is that many of these therapists would say, well, you know, the truth doesn't really matter. It's your emotional truth that matters. Well, of course the truth matters, and it matters very deeply to the family members. So
yes.
The other thing is that I'm pretty sure that this, it's been something like 9 or 10 million families that this has happened to in the United States.
That's
I did a survey earlier in 2017, the first such survey that's ever been done of over 2,000 adults. And about 5% of them had gone to therapy and come to remember abuse that they'd never recalled before. It's appalling.
Right. What is the experience? I mean, there are lots of people who have experienced documented trauma, like soldiers, for example, or
right.
Other cases. So in those cases, do people tend to remember what happened reasonably well, better than average?
Yes. Yeah. Of course they remember. That's what PTSD is, post-traumatic stress disorder, is being unable to forget horrible things that happened to you.
Yeah.
No, people do not forget. You know, people didn't walk out of Auschwitz saying, where was I?
Yes. Saying, I 4 years of my life just disappeared. I don't know what happened to me. I agree. And I mean, from my own perspective, I don't know if I've experienced any like severe traumas, but I've experienced some minor traumas and some really embarrassing events where I really completely embarrassed myself, and I have no trouble remembering those things. Some of them I wish I could forget.
Well, you know, what the other thing that happens is I wrote about multiple personality disorder, which mm-hmm. is sort of the lunatic fringe of the repressed memory movement, only they call it dissociation, but it doesn't matter what you call it. The idea that you could be severely abused and completely forget it. In this case, they make up that you had all these other, quote, personalities that you only discover when you go to therapy or read a terrible book, and that those other alternate personalities are the ones who remember this alleged terrible abuse. And the way that they convince many people of that is they say, well, you don't remember anything from second grade. Therefore, you must have developed an alternative personality to go through second grade, and we'll find that personality, we'll hypnotize you, and you can remember that. But the fact of the matter is, most of us don't remember a whole lot from second grade. You know, and if you were cued properly, you probably do remember stuff. But it's not abnormal. It doesn't show that some horrible thing happened to you then.
Right. There is, I mean, that is kind of a strange thing about memory, is that before a certain date, you basically remember nothing. I don't think, remembers anything of their first year.
No, in fact, nobody remembers anything their second year.
Yes.
There's some indication that some people remember stuff back to about 2 3/4 years old, but it's a period called infantile amnesia, and it's because your brain hasn't developed the pathways to store long-term memory until then.
Right.
And most people don't remember a whole lot from when they were 4 or 5 either.
Yeah.
And this is one of the worst things that happen. When I give speeches about this, I can say anything I want to, but when I say that, that upsets a lot of people in the audience, because most of us, many people, have cherished memories from when they were in the crib.
Really?
When they were 1 or maybe 2 years old. And I have to tell them, no, you don't. Yet that cherished memory is probably something somebody told you about and you rehearsed it in your mind until it became your memory. But you don't actually remember that.
Yeah, I mean, I think parents do that, right? There's a cute thing that, you know, happened to one of the children. I remember that. I lived in Europe when I was a kid, and we were camping by this big river, the Rhine or something, and my little brother, who was like 3 or 4, disappeared. And of course, my parents just completely freaked out, and they found him about an hour later sitting and chatting with one of the waitresses at the next door restaurant, to the great relief of everybody. But that story was told a few times, and my brother was probably way too young to remember it, but I wouldn't be surprised if I asked him about it, that he would give me the details about what he did.
That's That's a great story. It's similar to the story of Jean Piaget, the famous child psychologist, who one of his cherished early memories was that his nursemaid had been pushing him in a pram, and some men had tried to kidnap the baby, him, and the nurse had chased them off, and she had scratches on her face to show it. Only later, the nurse got religion, and she said that she had made the whole thing up to make herself look good.
Oh, so, but she had told the story, and of course he...
The story had become told over and over again, and it was something he, quote, remembered.
Right,
so it never happened.
And as a child, you have absolute faith in your parents, and if you have a nanny, in your nanny, I mean, they can do no wrong, right? Up to a certain age, then they can
right.
do no right. How much influence do you think money had on this whole thing? Because in the end, it became a pretty high stakes...
You're talking about the Sandusky case again?
Yeah, the Sandusky case.
I think that for the initial accusers, repressed memory therapy was highly important for many mm-hmm. of them. Once it became clear that this was going to be a money-making thing, being a Sandusky victim, which... really happened after November of 2011, when the story went viral and the media turned it into a moral panic. And it became quite clear that Penn State was going to pay anybody who claimed to be a victim. Then I think money became a much bigger factor, although the lawyers would send people to therapy, you know, to help develop their memories. And the police would suggest to people, if you remember anything more, please tell us. Call me. You know, if you maybe wake up at 3 in the morning and you think you recall something else, let us know. So they all believed in this repressed memory stuff.
What was the response of the police to people who'd been involved in Second Mile who said that Sandusky had done nothing wrong?
They were upset with them. They didn't believe them. They ignored them. There are some emails that I found where, one of them was saying, we've been talking to Second Mile kids lately, alumni lately, who say that they think Sandusky's a great guy and was a role model, and that they don't believe all these things that other people are saying. And that was very upsetting to the police, and they didn't believe them.
And you've been very critical of the role of the media. What do you think the media did wrong in presenting this case to the public?
Well, the media jumped on it as a wonder, you know, particularly because of Joe Paterno being involved. When the Penn State Board of Trustees reacted to this by immediately rolling over and playing dead and declaring everybody guilty, and they fired Joe Paterno after 50 years or so at, I can't remember how long, he was there forever at Penn State.
Mm-hmm.
Then the sports media particularly is at fault. And I really think it's because of football being regarded as kind of a religion, you know?
Right.
So the idea that a beloved former coach like Sandusky had done these evil things was so appalling. It was like desecrating the church, that you immediately have to turn him from a saint to the devil, the most evil person in the entire world, and that's what happened with the media and with Penn State and with anybody who lived in State College. So he was found guilty in the media within, you know, a few days of the grand jury presentment being made public at the end of 2011. And by the time of the trial, there was no way that he was going to get any kind of a fair trial in State College or in Pennsylvania, or for that matter, anywhere in the United States.
Yes. I mean, one person who did work on this, who is a journalist, is a guy named Ziegler. I guess he was a radio talk show host or something?
John Ziegler is a conservative radio talk show host, and he's also a documentary filmmaker. And he's also mm-hmm. very smart. And he had grown up in Pennsylvania, and he was upset about how Paterno had been treated, mostly. And he assumed that Sandusky was guilty. I have a whole chapter about Ziegler in the book. And he, you know, the more he looked into it, the more he thought the whole thing didn't make any sense. And then he actually went and interviewed Sandusky in prison, as I did later. And he began to doubt that he was guilty at all. And so he got himself into a lot of trouble for saying that. You read the chapter on him.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a very...
It's ironic that he and I are the ones who are saying this because we're not politically the same at all. John, how should I put this? He sort of has a talk show host personality.
Right.
He can be very abrasive and call people names, and I hope I don't do that.
Well, but
he's right. He's right about this, and he's been right for longer than anybody.
Right. I mean, he apparently secretly recorded Sandusky in prison, correct?
Well, Sandusky knew he was recording him, but he snuck a pen that had a recording device into the prison and recorded it.
Right. Reading the book, I felt, before I got to the part where you said it yourself, that Sandusky had terrible defense representation. I mean, maybe the book would be worth reading just from the point of view of how not to defend a client. But
oh, my God. It was amazing. I mean, the guy, the defense attorney was named Joe Amendola, and he was basically a small-town lawyer from State College, Pennsylvania, who was way over his head, who couldn't hear half the time. It was clear if you read the transcript, he hadn't heard what people were saying. And he wanted to be liked. He was one of these people who, you know, is self-deprecating and aw shucks, and he didn't want to really push anybody when he cross-examined them. And he began, and he did not pick jurors intelligently. He allowed jurors to be picked for the who clearly already had decided Sandusky was guilty. And in his opening statement, he said, "The state has overwhelming evidence against my client. I don't know how I'm going to defend this." It was incredible. It was the worst. Unbelievable.
Yeah, like in the book you say that Amendola said, well, he was just being sarcastic, but obviously didn't come over very well. And I mean, if you're going to try to pull a trick like that in court, you better be sure that the jury's going to understand what you're doing.
Because he's not being sarcastic.
He's just trying to defend himself later.
Yeah. No, I mean, I would have more sympathy for him if he hadn't, after the trial, he did some atrocious things. You know, he was laughing and joking and totally happy to be talking to Anderson Cooper after the trial. It was like he was giddy that he was going to be on national television. And he said, oh, the judge was so fair, and oh, the prosecution put on a great case, none of which was true. He basically threw Sandusky under the bus. It was just appalling.
Right. But what you're also saying implicitly is that the media didn't look at it critically. They had a monster, and they wanted to run with that.
That's true, and they still want to run with it. I'm a pretty well-known author, as you pointed out, and most of my books have been reviewed in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
Not this book. It's gotten two terrific reviews. One in the Skeptic magazine and one in the New York Journal of Books. But aside from that, it's been blackballed by the media. The sports media, the Associated Press, nobody wants to write about this book, even though it's extremely well-researched and quite compelling and would obviously be big news. But
yes,
it goes
well,
against their narrative that they absolutely, it would make them look terrible because they made a big mistake and they're not going to admit it.
It made a lot of sense to me. I would like to echo those comments. Those are not just the author praising his own book. I think what you say is true about the clarity of the book and how it sort of explains how something like this can happen. Because one of the things, like, for example, with a guy like Weinstein, who I believe there's evidence that Weinstein's guilty, I'm not trying to say he's innocent, but as soon as there were like 20 people accusing him, then he was guilty. But, you know, the number of accusations isn't necessarily proof of guilt.
I've become so skeptical about these cases that I always look at them individually. You know, I read the New Yorker article about Weinstein, and I'm quite convinced that he is guilty.
Right.
And I think that, about the Me Too movement, because many people have said, oh, your book has come out at a terrible time. I said, it's come out at a good time.
Yes.
This Me Too movement is going on, because many, many of these people told people what had gone on at the time.
Right.
Right? But nobody would listen to them or take them seriously or laugh them off. Nobody told anybody anything about Sandusky abusing them at the time they were supposed to be abused, because I don't think it was happening. But yeah, I think it's very important to look at each individual case and try to judge why and what really actually happened. And it's hard to do in the current media environment.
Well, let's do that, because you told me that you're writing an op-ed about Nassar, who is the doctor for Michigan State University's gymnastics team and the U.S. Olympic team. And so I think we can compare these two cases, because they both received...
Many people have compared the two cases of Larry Nassar and Jerry Sandusky, because
right.
both of them are alleged to be serial pedophiles in the context of highly competitive sports. Both of them were associated with universities that
right.
allegedly ignored the whole thing, et cetera. So, yeah, of course I've looked at the Nassar case.
Okay, well, let me go through some of the things I've taken from Nassar. So Nassar confessed to some crimes and pled guilty to some. What about Sandusky?
Sandusky has never pled guilty to anything and maintains his innocence to this day.
Nassar had child pornography in his possession.
That's right, and Sandusky had no pornography, child or adult, anywhere on his computer or in his home or in his office.
Ironically, some of the investigators did in the Sandusky
case. That's right,
the
investigators in the Sandusky case were caught in what came to be known as Porngate. They were sending horrible pornography between one another, which was sexist and misogynistic and racist. It was horrible.
In the Nassar case, the women were quite clear in stating that Nassar inserted a finger in their vagina or their anus. What happened in the early descriptions of the so-called victims of Sandusky?
Well, as I've said, most of them said nothing happened initially. And then the stories grew over time and often with therapy.
There are some stories of women, girls at the time, who reported what they felt was abuse and described how they were bullied, threatened, harassed. In one case, the female coach brought in the entire team, I think, and sort of made a big deal of it, essentially shaming the woman who tried to report. Did those things happen with Sandusky? You said nobody reported it early.
No. Nobody contemporarily told anybody, which is really surprising. People do delay disclosure of sexual abuse quite often, but they'll usually tell a friend or a parent or somebody something. Or a teacher, and in Sandusky's case, nothing.
Nassar's wife filed for divorce.
Sandusky's wife thinks he's innocent and visits him, drives several hours every week to go see him, and is totally supportive of him, as are his children, except for the one that went to get repressed memory therapy.
But everything you said about Nassar was not as negative as what's being reported in the trials. You quoted somebody of basically saying Nassar was kind of an island of friendliness in a sea of abuse that was the gymnastics.
Well, there was it's ironic because this is a former gymnast who was abused by Nassar. Her name is Jamie Dancher. She was an Olympic bronze medalist. and she said that going to Dr. Nasser was like a bright light. Larry was my buddy. Larry would make me laugh. Larry would say, oh, they're all horrible. I get it. Because she also talked about how abused she felt at the time, not by Nasser, but by her coaches, who told her how to eat and how to walk and what to wear and forced her to perform even when she had a fractured back. The ironic thing about Jamie Dancher's testimony was that she did not feel traumatized or abused at the time. She thought that these were legitimate medical treatments that he was doing to her. And that explains why so many of them didn't come forward at the time. It's only after it was revealed to her that these were not standard medical procedures that she became very, very bitter. And now she's very happy he's going to be in prison, and she said she hoped he is sexually abused in prison, quote, until the day he dies. The other thing to know about the Nasser case is he was practicing something called myofascial pain release.
Mm-hmm.
There's this theory, which I think is complete pseudoscience, that you can relieve people's pelvic pain and other pains all over their body and maybe even cure their migraine headaches by putting your finger inside their vagina and finding pressure points and releasing tension somehow or other. And so thousands of therapists and osteopaths are doing this to people now. Now, they wear gloves. They tell people what they're doing.
Right.
And they usually have a third party present. So Nasser wasn't doing any of that. He used his bare fingers. He had all this child porn, so it's quite clear to me that he was sexually abusing these women. It wasn't that he was just doing something medical.
Right.
But it's part and parcel of something which, to me, sounds like sexual abuse and is being presented as normal medicine.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the question is, is the therapy sexual abuse full stop, or could Nasser have done it if he had done it as therapy and not just because he seems to have liked putting his fingers in women, in girls' vaginas and anuses?
Well, as I said, there are plenty of doctors who are doing this to people, and under
yes.
And you can go on the internet. Go on the internet. Look up myofascial release. MyoFascial.
Right.
Release. Look it up. You'll see what I'm talking about.
Yes. Another, going back to Sandusky, another characteristic of Sandusky you've mentioned was he would have showers with the boys. And when we were talking earlier, I had said, you know, when I was, my mother was a working mother, so she dropped me off at the Y all the time for swimming lessons, for summer camps and things like that. And, you know, after whatever you were doing, you'd go in the shower and there'd be adult men and boys, and nobody really thought anything of it. But now there's a certain suspiciousness that can occur with adults being naked with
right.
boys. And Sandusky went further, as you said. He would horse around with them. He'd roll around on the bed. And the assumption now is that that's sexual abuse. But, I mean, the way it's described, it sounds like just a big kid who never, you know, fully grew up in some ways.
Yeah. Well, the last part of the book, the last basic third of the book, is about what Sandusky was like, how he was raised, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's called The Real Jerry Sandusky. His parents ran a recreation center in the town of Washington, Pennsylvania, and they were much beloved by everybody. But they didn't have their own shower. They lived on the second floor. So everybody took showers together. I mean,
mm-hmm.
the men and the boys did.
Right.
And Sandusky grew up in this atmosphere and just absolutely adored his parents and wanted to be like his father, who had helped a lot of troubled kids, which is why he started the Second Mile. And, you know, I interviewed somebody who grew up near Sandusky, and he said, oh, yeah, we, of course, we would all take showers together. He said, at the YMCA, all the boys took off their clothes entirely to go swimming. We didn't wear bathing suits. So Sandusky grew up in what his children described to me as a Mayberry world, that he was just clueless about, you know, that this might get him in trouble or something, or that there was anything the matter with it. He was incredibly stupid and naive about this sort of thing.
When my two daughters were about 8 years old, I promised to take them and their each of their best friends to go camping. So I headed out into the forest not too far from Calgary, and there's me, a 40-year-old man with 4 8-year-old girls, and I'm just thinking I'm lucky. At the time, I thought nothing of it, but I'm lucky there wasn't some nosy person who assumed that the only reason to take 4 8-year-old girls into the forest was to abuse them. I mean, it was a public campsite, but still, that wouldn't stop people from being
suspicious. Yeah, and I doubt you would do that today. I said in my book that if Jesus were alive today, he would be in big trouble for saying, "Let the children come unto me." You know, it's just not done. But that's who Sandusky was.
I think that, I mean, I'm one of the things I'm concerned of is that we've basically sexualized all touch, that touch is always interpreted as sexual, especially between an older person and a younger person, or between a man and a woman. And, you know, I think touch is very important to people. Everybody who can remember their parents giving them a hug when they came home upset from school or when they hurt themselves can attest to the fact that a human touch is very important. And people can become very psychologically disturbed if they're completely isolated, such as solitary confinement, you know, which is the exclusion of almost all human contact. And yet we're, you know, by sort of making all of this stuff criminally suspicious, I'm not sure we're going to end up in a better place.
Well, I think you're right. In Memory Warp, I have a subsection of a chapter, of the final chapter, that says, "A hug is not sex abuse." And I quoted an old book by Ashley Montague called Touching, talking about the importance of human touch. You know, and the classic experiments of Harry Harlow with monkeys. He showed the devastating effect of raising monkeys with a surrogate mother that was just a bunch of wire.
Right.
And they would pine away and die. So, yes, we need nurturing touch. And, of course, we do not need sexual abuse. We do not need unwanted touch. We do not need sexual harassment. So let's make that abundantly clear. But
right.
That's not what was going on in the Sandusky case.
Yes. I think that if we create these panics, we can have unintended negative consequences, apart from the negative consequences to Sandusky and his family. Like, I'm sure his wife and his children are devastated by the fact that their father, their husband, is probably going to die in jail. Now, there was an attempt to get a new hearing, but that did not succeed, did it?
Well, there was an attempt. First, the way that these cases work is, first you have to appeal. He lost his appeal. Then
right.
You do something called post-conviction relief based on the fact that he had ineffective counsel, that there was new evidence, and that the Constitution had been violated in various ways, all of which was clearly true.
Right.
So he should have gotten a new trial, but he has not been granted one yet. All the judges in Pennsylvania are elected, and so it's very unlikely that any judge in that state is going to grant the evil pedophile Jerry Sandusky a new trial. You know, that's the public perception. So it's not going to happen. So it's probably going to take another year or two for this to wind its way through the appeal courts in Pennsylvania. But after that, then his lawyers can apply for a writ of habeas corpus on the federal level. And I think there's an excellent chance that he will get a new trial, because it's just obvious that he should.
Well, that will be interesting to see, especially the media response to that. Anyway, we have gone through the allotted time, so I'd just like to give you one last chance to address anything that we haven't got to yet.
Well, we certainly covered the waterfront in lots of ways.
Yes.
I would just, again, urge people to read the book. Read the whole book before you draw any conclusion at all, whether it's, that I'm right or that I'm wrong. And along with it, I hope you'll read, so that's called The Most Hated Man in America. And along with that, I do hope you'll read Memory Warp, which is in many ways a more important book, because it really goes into detail about how this whole myth of repressed memory came to be and is still going on.
Yeah, I think both sides of the story are important. Like an individual case that illustrates a general point is important because it shows in detail how this can affect people's lives, but also getting the bigger picture is important too. So yeah, I think both of them are different sides of a coin. Thank you for writing them, and thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
Goodbye. Well, that was pretty heavy. Nothing like talking about sexual abuse and possible false convictions. And also in the Nassar case of what appears to be a genuine and very significant case of sexual abuse against hundreds of girls, now mostly women. One of the things that struck me about the Nassar case was that the non-sexual abuse in U.S. gymnastics was pervasive, and that some of the people who preserved the establishment were powerful women. I've always thought this is about power more than it's about sex. Hillary Clinton also, it's turned out recently, protected a sexual abuser, not her husband. She did that rather than believe the victim. If we're going to believe the victim, then the leader of the Green Party of Canada, the much-loved politician Elizabeth May, should be fired because more than one ex-employee has accused her of abuse. Not sexual, but abuse by yelling and insulting. People have leapt to the defense of this progressive and widely admired politician, many of them probably proud Me Too supporters. One of her colleagues and friends, Kent Hare, has also been accused and has at least temporarily lost his job as a Liberal cabinet minister. One woman has claimed, actually two now, that he made them feel unsafe. To put this in context, Kent is almost a quadriplegic. He has limited mobility and very little strength in his arms and no movement in his legs. He was paralyzed by a drive-by shooting many years ago. The first woman to complain said that he called her yummy, and she also said that no woman wanted to get into an elevator alone with him. I do know Kent a little bit. I also know Elizabeth May, because Kent's a Calgary politician. Whenever I see him, maybe a dozen times I've seen him, he greets me like I'm his best friend, which I know I'm not. So is he just overly effusive, which offends some people? Or is he sexually abusive when alone with women? Before he's punished, I'd like to know what the truth is. My worry is that while men are more prone to violence and sexual aggression than women, women are just as prone as men to the other deadly sins, including jealousy, envy, greed, lust, pride, exaggeration, and so on. Thank you for listening to episode 172 of The Infectious Myth. If you've got a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.